answer. Actually, it had very little effect on me, because I knew why they had done it. Question. So it didn't upset you? Answer. No, it definitely didn't upset me. Question. You didn't decide that you would rather not continue living with murderers? Answer. Obviously not. Question. Were you upset that you didn't get to go along with them? Answer. I wanted to go. Mary Brunner, first member of the Manson family, claimed that the police had told her that she would be charged with murder if she did not implicate Manson in the Hinman slaying. She now repudiated this testimony and further denied ever being at the Hinman residence. Keith brought out that Mary Brunner had testified both in the second trial of Bobby Beausoleil and before the Hinman grand jury, and neither time did she say anything about Leslie Van Houten being present when Hinman was killed. I had no questions for her. The point was made. Brenda McCann was recalled to the stand to testify that on the nights of the Tate and LaBianca murders, she had seen Manson sleeping with Stephanie Schramm in Devil's Canyon. The groundwork for my cross-examination of Brenda had been laid 15 months before. I impeached her with her testimony before the grand jury when she stated that she couldn't remember where she or Manson was on either night. Brenda was the last witness. She completed her testimony on Tuesday, March 16th, 1971. That afternoon, after a number of delays, Kenrick, for example, refused to stipulate that Gary Hinman was dead, the defense rested. Wednesday, we worked on the jury instructions, and on Thursday, the trial entered its final stage. All that now remained were the arguments, the deliberations, and the verdict. March 18th to 29th, 1971. My opening argument in the penalty trial was brief, lasting less than 10 minutes. As with all my arguments during the trial, Manson decided to sit this one out in the lockup. The psychology behind this was obvious. He didn't want the jury focusing on him when I discussed him. I began by saying I am not going to address myself to the frantic effort by the three female defendants and the defense witnesses to make it look like Charles Manson wasn't involved in these murders. I am sure all of you clearly saw that they were lying on that witness stand to do what they could for their god, Charles Manson. Well, Charles Manson has already been convicted. He has already been convicted of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. The difficulty in your decision, as I see it, is not whether these defendants deserve the death penalty, ladies and gentlemen. In view of the incredibly savage, barbaric, and inhuman murders they committed, the death penalty is the only proper verdict. I then stated the very heart of my argument. If this case were not a proper case for the imposition of the death penalty, no case ever would be. In view of what they did, life imprisonment would be the greatest gift, the greatest charity, the greatest handout, as it were, ever given. The difficulty in your decision, as I see it, is whether you will have the fortitude to return verdicts of death against all 4 defendants. The defense attorneys, I anticipated, would beg for their clients' lives. This was not only commendable, I told the jury, it was also understandable, just as it was understandable that they argued during the guilt phase that their clients were not involved in these murders, even though during the penalty phase the 3 female defendants took the stand and said, yes, we were involved. There was absolutely no reason for these defendants to viciously and inhumanly snuff out the lives of these 7 human beings, I noted. There were no mitigating circumstances. These defendants are not human beings, ladies and gentlemen. Human beings have a heart and a soul. No one with a heart and a soul could have done what these defendants did to these 7 victims. These defendants are human monsters, human mutations. There is only 1 proper ending to the Tate-LaBianca murder trial, I concluded. Verdicts of death for all 4 defendants. Kenrick stipulated at the start of his argument that Mr. Manson is not all good. However, he continued, Mr. Manson is innocent of these matters that are before us. Why was he on trial then? Kenrick returned to his two favorite themes. Mr. Manson has had quite a share of troubles because of the fact that he likes girls. And he was only brought to trial so someone in the district attorney's office can have a gold star and say, I got Charles Manson. Kenrick's argument stretched over 3 days. It was occasionally ridiculous, as when he said, We can perform a public service for the United States of America by giving these people life, because if there is a revolution, this is the kind of thing that could spark it. It was sometimes unintentionally funny, as when he stated that, unlike Patricia Krenwinkle and Leslie Van Houten, Charles Manson has no family to come here to testify. But mostly, he tried to plant little seeds of doubt. Why, if Susan Atkins lied on the stand to absolve Manson, would she have implicated him in the Hinman murder? Wasn't the fact that Manson himself shot Crow to protect the people at Spawn Ranch evidence that he didn't need to order others to act for him? If these girls were lying about Manson's non-involvement in the murders, wouldn't they have also lied and said they had sorrow and remorse? Kenrick only briefly mentioned the copycat motive. He didn't even try to argue it. Instead, he suggested still another alternative motive. But for the fact that at least some of these people, supposedly referring to the Tate victims, were engaged in a narcotic episode of some type, these events would not have taken place. Day Shin, who argued next, fastened on Dr. Hockman's statement that he believed these girls had subconscious, if not conscious, remorse. As for Susan, she is still young, Shin argued. She is only 22 years old. I believe there is still a hope of rehabilitating her. Maybe someday she may be rehabilitated to the extent that she may finally realize what she has done was not right. I believe that she deserves the chance, an opportunity, so that maybe someday she may be released and live the rest of her life out of prison. This was very bad strategy on Shin's part, implying that if Susan Atkins was given life imprisonment, she might someday be released on parole. By law, the prosecution can't argue this. It is so prejudicial to the defendant. Of the four defense attorneys, Maxwell Keith gave the best opening argument. He was also the only one who really attempted to rebut my contentions. Mr. Bugliosi tells you that if the death penalty is not appropriate in this case, it would never be appropriate. Well, I wonder if it ever is appropriate. Mr. Bugliosi read to you at the close of his argument on the guilt phase the roll call of the dead. Let me read to you now, ladies and gentlemen, the roll call of the living dead. Leslie, Sadie, Katie, Squeaky, Brenda, Uish, Sandy, Kathy, Gypsy, Tex, Clem, Mary, Snake, and no doubt many more. These lives, and the lives of these three young women in particular, have been so damaged that it is possible in some cases their destruction is beyond repair. I hope not, but it is possible. Leslie Van Houten, he strongly argued, was capable of rehabilitation. She should be studied, not killed. I am not asking you to forgive her, although to forgive is divine. I am asking you to give her the chance to redeem herself. She deserves to live. What she did was not done by the real Leslie. Let the Leslie of today die. She will, slowly, and maybe painfully. And let the Leslie, as she once was, live again. Nowhere in Paul Fitzgerald's argument, which followed, did he state or even imply that Manson was responsible for what had happened to Patricia Krenwinkle. Patricia Krenwinkle is 23 years old, Fitzgerald observed. With 365 days in the year, there are approximately 8,400 days in 23 years and approximately 200,000 hours in her lifetime. The perpetration of these offenses took, at best, approximately 3 hours. Is she to be judged solely on what occurred during of 200,000 hours? Just before court commenced on March 23rd, I walked over to the water cooler. Manson, in the nearby lockup, called out to me rather loudly, "If I get the death penalty, there is going to be a lot of bloodletting, because I am not going to take it." Both the court clerk and Steve Kay overheard the remark. Kay intemperately rushed out of the courtroom and repeated it to the press. Learning of this, I asked the reporters not to print it. The Herald Examiner wouldn't agree, and it broke the story with a banner headline, "Manson Death Threat. Warns of terror if doomed to die." Before this, however, Judge Older, made aware of what had happened, decided that rather than wait to the close of arguments, he would sequester the jury immediately. In my final argument, I rebutted point by point the earlier defense contentions. For example, the defense had claimed that Linda got her story from listening to the Susan Atkins tapes. Why would Linda need to listen to the tapes, I asked, when she was present both nights? Kenrick had told the jury that if they returned death penalty verdicts, they would be killers. This was a very heavy argument. As support, he cited the fifth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." In answer, I told the jury that most biblical scholars and theologians interpret the original language to mean, "Thou shalt not commit murder," which is exactly how it appears in the New English Bible, dated 1970. The Ten Commandments appear in Exodus chapter 20, I noted. What Kenrick did not mention, I observed, is that the very next chapter authorizes the death penalty. Exodus 21 verse 12 reads, "Whoever strikes a man a mortal blow must be put to death," while verse 14 of the same chapter reads, "When a man kills another, after maliciously scheming to do so, you must take him even from my altar and put him to death." Kenrick argued that there was no domination. In addition to all the evidence during the guilt trial, I observed during the penalty trial, when Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten played the part of the sacrificial lamb and admitted their participation in these murders, and then lied on that witness stand and said that Manson wasn't involved, the fact that they were willing to lie on that witness stand just proves all the more Manson's domination over them. As for the other family witnesses, Squeaky, Sandy, and the others, all of them sounded like a broken record on that witness stand. They all have the same thought. They use the same language. Each one was a carbon copy of the other. They are all still totally subservient and subject to Charles Manson. They are his exiled slaves. I came now to the copycat motive. My objective was to completely demolish it, yet not dwell on it so long that it would seem like I was giving it credence. "It is really laughable, ladies and gentlemen," I began, "the way the three female defendants and the defense witnesses sought to take the hat off Charles Manson. They had to come up with a motive for these murders other than helter-skelter. Why? Because no less than 10 witnesses during the guilt trial had irrevocably connected Manson with helter-skelter, so they certainly could not say from that witness stand that the motive for these murders was helter-skelter. If they said that, they would be saying, yes, Charles Manson masterminded these murders." So they came up with the copycat motive. I could give you between 20 and 30 reasons why it's obvious that this nonsensical story of the defense was fabricated out of whole cloth, but I won't take up your time with it, and I am not going to insult your intelligence. I did point out a few. Linda Kasabian testified during the penalty trial that she had never heard anyone discuss committing these murders to free Bobby Beausoleil. Gary Hinman was stabbed not more than 4 times. Wojtek Frykowski was stabbed 51 times. Rosemary LaBianca 41 times. Lino LaBianca 26 times. Rather a great difference if these were copycat slayings. And if these murders were to be carbon copies, why weren't the words "political piggy" used at the Tate and LaBianca residences? And why no bloody paw print at the latter two houses? The most powerful evidence demolishing this ridiculous motive, I noted, was that as early as February 1969, long before there was any Hinman murder to copy, long before there were any words political piggy to copy, Manson told Brooks Poston and other family members, including all of his co-defendants, that, quoting Poston, he said a group of real blacks would come out of the ghettos and do an atrocious crime in the richer sections of Los Angeles and other cities. They would do an atrocious murder with stabbing, killing, cutting bodies to pieces, smearing blood on the walls, writing pigs on the walls. Writing pigs on the walls, I repeated. So writing pig at the Tate and LaBianca residences was simply a part of Manson's blueprint for starting Helter Skelter, not an effort to copy the Hinman murder. Incidentally, I observed, Mr. Kennerick never did try to explain to you why the words Helter Skelter were printed in blood on the refrigerator door at the LaBianca residence. What does Helter Skelter have to do with freeing Bobby Beausoleil or an alleged $1,000 MDA burn at the Tate residence? Absolutely nothing, that's what. The words Helter Skelter were found printed in blood on the LaBianca refrigerator door because all of the evidence at this trial shows beyond all doubt that Helter Skelter was the principal reason for these savage murders. Yes, I admitted, there is a connection between the Hinman murder and the Tate LaBianca murders. But it was not this silly Bobby Beausoleil nonsense. Here is the connection. Mr. Manson not only ordered the Tate LaBianca murders, he also ordered the Hinman murder. That is the connection. As for Susan Atkins' claim that Linda Kasabian masterminded these murders, I noted that not until the penalty phase did she say anything about this, and then all of a sudden Linda Kasabian is Charles Manson. I noted some of the reasons why this was preposterous, among them the ridiculousness of the docile, subservient Linda taking over the leadership of the family in just 1 month. Only one person ordered these murders, ladies and gentlemen, and his initials are C.M. He also has an A.K.A., J.C., and he is in that lockup right now listening to me. The most preposterous thing about all this was that supposedly for 1.5 years both Sadie and Gypsy kept this secret in their perjurous bosoms. They not only didn't tell the other members of the family, they didn't even tell Manson's attorney, though both testified they loved and would willingly die for Charlie. And why didn't they tell him about this motive? Because it didn't exist. It was recently fabricated. As for Manson's alibi, that he was with Stephanie Schramm in Devil's Canyon on both of these nights, isn't it strange that all of Mr. Manson's extant slaves have testified to this during the penalty trial, and the very person, Stephanie Schramm, whom they claim Manson was with, testified that Manson was not with her? I then addressed myself to the issue of whether the four defendants should receive the death penalty. The strongest argument that can be made in support of capital punishment is, I feel, deterrence, that it may save additional lives. Unfortunately, under California law, the prosecution could not argue deterrence, only retribution. These weren't typical murders, ladies and gentlemen. This was a one-sided war where unspeakable atrocities were committed. If all of these defendants don't receive the death penalty, the typical first-degree murderer only deserves 10 days in the county jail. As for Fitzgerald's contention that killing these defendants would not bring the 7 victims back to life, if we were to accept that line of reasoning, no one would ever be punished for any crime, since punishing a person does not remove the fact that the crime was committed. For example, don't punish a man for arson, because the punishment is not going to rebuild the building. In California, if a defendant is 17 years of age or younger, he or she cannot be sentenced to death. Though Fitzgerald repeatedly called the 3 female defendants children, I reminded the jury that Leslie was 21, Susan 22, Katie 23. They are adults by any standard, and completely responsible for their acts. In regard to the defense contention that the 3 female defendants were insane, I reminded the jury that Dr. Hockman, the only psychiatrist to examine all 3, said they are not and have never been insane. Dr. Hochman testified that we are all capable of killing, I noted. He did not say that we are all capable of murder. There is a vast difference between killing, as in justifiable homicide, self-defense, or defense of others, and murder. And no one can convince me, ladies and gentlemen, that all of us are capable of murdering strangers for no reason whatsoever, like these three female defendants did. It takes a special type of person to do what they did. It takes a person who places no value on the life of a fellow human being. True. Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten committed these murders because Charles Manson told them to, but they would never have committed these murders in a million years if they did not already have murder in their guts, in their system. Manson merely told them to do what they were already capable of doing. Moreover, there was no evidence that Manson forced Watson and the girls to murder for him. In fact, the inference is that they wanted to go along. That seemed to be the general feeling in the family. Witness the statement of Kathy Gillies. Witness Susan Atkins telling Juan Flynn, "We're going to get some fucking pigs." Does that sound like someone who is being forced to go out? Manson ordered the murders, but Watson and the three girls personally committed them because they wanted to. Make no mistake about that. If they did not want to murder these victims, all they had to do was not do it. I examined now the backgrounds of the three girls. Like the other female members of the family, they had one common denominator among them. It was obvious that each of them had a revulsion, an antipathy, a seething feeling of disgust for society, for their own parents. Each of the three girls had dropped out of society before even meeting Charles Manson. Each had taken LSD and other drugs before meeting Manson, and each had rejected her real family before meeting Manson. Looking right at juror Jean Roseland, who had two teenage daughters, I said, "Don't confuse them with the girl next door type. These three female defendants had repudiated and renounced their very families and society before they ever met Charles Manson. In fact, it was precisely because they had contemptuously disavowed and rejected their families and society that they ended up with Charles Manson. That is the very reason. Manson was simply the catalyst, the moving force that translated their pre-existing disgust and hatred for society and human beings into violence." I anticipated an argument that I felt Maxwell Keith might give. "The thought certainly may enter your mind that as wicked and as vicious as these three female defendants are, by comparison to Charles Manson, they are nowhere as wicked and vicious as he is. Therefore, let's give Manson the death penalty, and these three female defendants life imprisonment. The only problem with that type of approach is that these female defendants are given credit, as it were, because of Manson's extreme wickedness and viciousness. Under that type of reasoning, if Adolf Hitler were Charles Manson's co-defendant, Manson should receive life imprisonment because of the indescribably evil Adolf Hitler." Rather than compare the three female defendants with Manson, I told the jury, they should evaluate the conduct of each of the defendants and determine whether it warranted the imposition of the death penalty. I then went into the acts of each, starting with Manson, enumerating one by one the reasons they deserved death rather than life. One question the jury would surely ask, I noted, was, "Why no remorse?" The answer was simple. Manson and his co-defendants like to kill human beings. That is why they have no remorse. As Paul Watkins testified, "Death is Charlie's trip." I came to the end of my argument. "Now the defense attorneys want you to give these defendants a break. Did these defendants give the seven victims in this case a break? Now the defense attorneys want you to give their clients another chance. Did these defendants give the seven victims in this case any chance at all? Now the defense attorneys want you to have mercy on their clients. Did these defendants have any mercy at all on the seven victims in this case when they begged and pleaded for their lives?" I then reminded the jurors that 9 months earlier, during voir dire, each had told me he would be willing to vote death if he felt this was a proper case. I reiterated, if the death penalty is to mean anything in the state of California other than two empty words, this is a proper case. I concluded, on behalf of the people of the state of California, I can't thank you enough for the enormous public service you have rendered as jurors in this very long, historic trial. That night, after dinner, I said to Gail, there must be something I have to do tonight. But there wasn't. For a year and a half, 7 days a week, I had been totally immersed in the case. Now all I could do was listen to the closing arguments of the defense attorneys and wait until the jury reached its verdict. Kenrick began by implying that perhaps I had poisoned the glass of water on the lectern, and ended, more than a day later, by reading chapter after chapter from the New Testament. Now, this being the Easter season, there is an analogy here between Mr. Manson. This may sound at first blush to be ridiculous, and we are not suggesting that Mr. Manson is the deity or Christ-like or anything like that, but how can we know? Judge Older, who had several times warned Kenrick that he had exhausted all relevant rebuttal, finally brought his sermon to an end at the point of resurrection. Shin spent his time attacking the DA's office, and in particular me. Miss Atkins was drowning without friends, and she saw Mr. Bugliosi with an oar. She said, oh, here comes help now. Miss Atkins reached out for that oar. And what do you think Mr. Bugliosi did? He hit her over the head with the oar. Keith delivered a strong argument against the death penalty itself. Before this, however, he said, now strangely, or perhaps not so strangely, I accepted wholeheartedly certain areas of Mr. Bugliosi's argument. I accept his exposition to you that Mr. Manson dominated these girls and ordered the homicides. I accept that the free Bobby Beausoleil motive is nonsense. I accept his telling you that you shouldn't hold the Hinman murder against Leslie. I accept his argument that Leslie's testimony and the testimony of the other girls in this case shows Mr. Manson's domination and influence still persists and is all-pervasive. To deny these things, Keith said, would be to deny the evidence. Thus, Keith became the first and only defense attorney to accuse Manson of these murders. Keith, however, said that he did not agree that any of the defendants should receive the death penalty, not even Charles Manson. For in his opinion, Keith said, Mr. Manson is insane, and in instilling his thoughts into the minds of the three female defendants, he had also infected them with his madness. Keith concluded, give Leslie the chance for redemption, to which she is entitled. Remember, Linda Kasabian cut the umbilical cord, in Mr. Bugliosi's words, that tied her to Manson and his family. Give Leslie the chance to do the same. Give her life. I thank you. Fitzgerald read a short argument, at the end of which he began describing in detail how the three female defendants would be executed in the gas chamber at San Quentin Prison if the jury returned verdicts of death. This was improper argument, and I objected. When we approached the bench, Paul literally begged Judge Older to let him proceed. This is extremely important. I can't impress on the court how important it is. Because he was so desperate, I decided to back off, agreeing not to object if he would describe this as a hypothetical situation. Imagine that this is happening, and not as fact. He did so, after which Judge Older instructed the jury. They left the courtroom at 5:25 p.m. on Friday, March 26, 1971. While I felt confident that the jury would return a death penalty verdict against Charles Manson, I was less sure when it came to the girls. Only four females had been executed in California history, none of them as young as the defendants. I had anticipated that the jury would be out at least 4 days. When I received the call Monday afternoon after only 2 days, I knew there could be only one verdict. It was too fast for anything else. Their actual deliberations, I later learned, had taken only 10 hours. Again, under extraordinary security precautions, the jury was brought back into the courtroom at 4:24 p.m. on Monday, March 29th, with their verdicts. Manson and the girls had been brought into the courtroom earlier, the three female defendants now, when it was too late to influence the jury, having shaved their heads also, but before the clerk could read the first verdict, Manson yelled, "I don't see how you can get by with this without letting me put on some kind of defense. You people have no authority over me. Half of you in here ain't as good as I am." An older ordered him removed. Manson's no-defense claim was nonsense. It was obvious that the defense he intended to put on during the guilt phase had been delivered in toto during the penalty phase. The jury's reaction to it was now being delivered, in a courtroom jammed with spectators and press. The clerk read the first verdict. "We, the jury in the above-entitled action, having found the defendant Charles Manson guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in count one of the indictment, do now fix the penalty as death." Krenwinkel: "You have just judged yourselves." Atkins: "Better lock your doors and watch your own kids." Van Houten: "Your whole system is a game. You blind, stupid people. Your children will turn against you." Judge Older had the three girls removed. They too listened over the loudspeaker as the clerk fixed the penalty for all four defendants as death on all counts. Judge Older left the bench to shake hands with each juror. "If it were within the power of a trial judge to award a Medal of Honor to jurors," he told them, "believe me, I would bestow an award on each of you." For the first time, the jurors could speak to the press about their ordeal. Jury foreman Herman Tubick told reporters that the jury was convinced the motive was helter-skelter. Mrs. Thelma McKenzie said the jury had certainly tried to find points upon which they could sentence the female defendants to a verdict less severe, but we couldn't. William McBride remarked, "I felt sympathy for the women, but sympathy can't interfere with justice. What they did deserves the death penalty." Marie Mesmer said she felt more pity for Susan Atkins than for the other two girls because of her background, but that she was shocked when all three showed no signs of remorse. As for Manson, she said, "I wanted to protect society. I think Manson is a very dangerous influence." Jean Roseland, mother of three teenagers, two of them girls, said the most terrible part of the whole trial was Leslie Van Houten looking at me with those big brown eyes. Mrs. Roseland was convinced Manson's power to manipulate others came not from within himself, but from the voids within the minds and souls of his followers. Later, Life ran an article entitled "The Manson Jury, End of a Long Ordeal." Ironically, there appeared in the same issue an article entitled "Paul McCartney on the Beatles' Breakup." That there had been irreconcilable troubles within the group became apparent, McCartney said, while they were making the White Album. Colonel Paul Tait was reported to have said regarding the death sentence verdicts, "That's what we wanted. That's what we expected. But there's no jubilation in something like this, no sense of satisfaction. It's more a feeling that justice has been done. Naturally, I wanted the death penalty. They took my daughter and my grandchild." Mrs. Tait told reporters that she didn't believe any human being should have the power to take a life, that that was up to God. Roman Polanski declined comment, as did the other relatives of the victims whom the media contacted. Sandy, Kathy, and the other girls on the corner had threatened to burn themselves to death with gasoline if any of the four were given death sentences. They didn't carry out their threat, though all did later shave their heads. On learning of the decision, Sandy looked into the TV cameras and screamed, "Death? That's what you're all going to get." With the exception of the sentencing, the trial was over. It had been the longest murder trial in American history, lasting 9.5 months. the most expensive costing approximately $1 million, and the most highly publicized, while the jury had been sequestered 225 days, longer than any jury before it. The trial transcript alone ran to 209 volumes, 31,716 pages, approximately 8 million words, a mini library. For almost everyone, the ordeal was not only long but expensive. A number of the jurors, anticipating that they would be paid by their employers, now found themselves either unpaid or without jobs. Mrs. Roseland, for example, claimed that TWA did not honor a verbal agreement to keep her on salary until the end of the trial, and estimated she lost about $2,700 in back pay. TWA denied there was any such agreement. There were several such denials. The financial sacrifice on the part of the defense attorneys was enormous. Fitzgerald said, "It's just really wiped me out." He told a reporter that he had lost about $30,000 in income and incurred $10,000 in trial expenses. He had been forced to sell his stereo and other possessions and had spent $5,000, which he didn't have. Six times married Day Shin said, "I'm behind in my house payments and child support and my alimonies." Shin had received $19,000 in royalties from the Atkins book, he said, but he claimed that about $16,000 of it went back to the Manson family. Kenrick refused to discuss his financial situation. Another of the defense attorneys did tell me, however, that at one point during the trial, Manson had ordered Shin to give Kenrick $5,000 from the Atkins account to help defray his expenses, but how much more he received, if any, is unknown. Keith, who received a fee from the county since he was court-appointed, admitted his private practice had gone downhill and that he didn't expect to gain any new clients as a result of the publicity. The trial cost another attorney his life. In the avalanche of stories on the Manson verdict, one small item which appeared that same day went almost unnoticed. The Ventura County Sheriff's Office reported that they had found a body believed to be that of the missing defense attorney, Ronald Hughes. The badly decomposed corpse had been found face down, wedged between two boulders in Sespe Creek, miles from where Hughes had last been seen alive. Two fishermen had discovered the body early Saturday, but didn't report it until Sunday night because we didn't want to spoil our fishing trip. The cause of death was, at this time, unknown. Through our office, I ordered an immediate autopsy. April 19th, 1971. Judge Older had set Monday, April 19th, 1971, as the date of sentencing. There was speculation that Older might decide on his own to reduce at least some of the verdicts from death to life. In a previous case, Older had done this for a defendant who had poured gasoline on two beds where four children were sleeping, killing one of them. However, I personally felt that since Older had complimented the jurors, he wouldn't turn right around and set aside their verdict. On the 19th, the court heard and rejected a number of defense motions, including those for a new trial. Judge Older then asked the defendants if they had anything to say. Only Manson did. Charlie's left hand was trembling, and he seemed near tears. Very meekly, with a quivering voice, he said, "I accept this court as my father. I have always done my best in my life to uphold the laws of my father, and I accept my father's judgment." The court. After 9.5 months of trial, all of the superlatives had been used, all of the hyperbole has been indulged in, and all that remains are the bare, stark facts of 7 senseless murders, 7 people whose lives were snuffed out by total strangers. I have carefully looked, in considering this action, for mitigating circumstances, and I have been unable to find any. It is my considered judgment that not only is the death penalty appropriate, but it is almost compelled by the circumstances. I must agree with the prosecutor that if this is not a proper case for the death penalty, what would be? Speaking to Manson, Judge Older said, "The Department of Corrections is ordered to deliver you to the custody of the warden of the state prison of the state of California at San Quentin, to be by him put to death in the manner prescribed by law of the state of California." There was at this time no death row for women. A special isolation wing was being constructed at the California Institute for Women at Frontera, and Atkins, Krenwinkle, and Van Houten were sent there to await execution. It was anticipated that the appeals would take at least 2 and possibly as long as 5 years. In actuality, their fate would be decided in less than 1. After the sentencing, I didn't anticipate ever seeing Charles Manson again. But I'd see him twice more, the last time under very peculiar circumstances. Epilogue. A Shared Madness. A more comprehensive description of her condition will necessitate further study, but at this time we might suggest the possibility that she may be suffering from a condition of folie à famille, a kind of shared madness within a group situation. Dr. Joel Hochman, in his psychiatric report on Susan Atkins. I lived with Charlie for 1 year straight and on and off for 2 years. I know Charlie. I know him inside and out. I became Charlie. Everything I once was Charlie. There was nothing left of me anymore. And all of the people in the family, there's nothing left of them anymore. They're all Charlie, too. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film, Manson. Paul Watkins. We are what you have made us. We were brought up on your TV. We were brought up watching Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, FBI, Combat. Combat was my favorite show. I never missed Combat. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film, Manson. Brenda. Whatever is necessary, you do it. When somebody needs to be killed, there's no wrong. You do it, and then you move on. And you pick up a child, and you move him to the desert. You pick up as many children as you can, and you kill whoever gets in your way. That is us. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film, Manson. Sandy. If you find an apple that has a little spot on it, you cut out that spot. Squeaky. You just better hope I never get out. Bobby Beausoleil. A Shared Madness. Although Manson and the girls had been convicted, the trials and the murders were not yet over. For their part in the attempted murder of prosecution witness Barbara Hoyt, 4 of the 5 defendants served 90 days in the county jail, while the 5th escaped punishment entirely. Although I was not assigned to the case, I questioned the way it was handled. Because it was felt that the evidence against the defendants was weak, and because of the expense of flying in witnesses from Hawaii, the DA's office, LAPD, and the defense attorneys agreed to a deal. In return for the defendants pleading no contest to 1 count of conspiracy to dissuade a witness from testifying, the prosecutor made a motion to reduce the charge from a felony to a misdemeanor. Judge Stephen Stothers granted the motion, and on April 16, 1971, he sentenced 4 of the 5 defendants, Lynette Frome, a.k.a. Squeaky, Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, and Dennis Rice, to 90 days in the county jail. Since they had already served 15 days, they were back on the streets in 75 days. The 5th defendant, Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, the girl who actually gave Barbara Hoyt the LSD-laden hamburger, got off scot-free. When it came time for sentencing, she failed to appear. Although a bench warrant was issued for her arrest and she was known to be living in Carson City, Nevada, the DA's office decided it wasn't worth the trouble to extradite her. Charles Tex Watson went on trial in August 1971. A good portion of my preparation took place not in a law library but in a medical library, since I was relatively sure that Watson was going to plead not guilty by reason of insanity and put on a psychiatric defense. The trial had three possible phases: guilt, sanity, and penalty, each of which presented its own special problems. Even though defense attorney Sam Bubrick told me that Watson intended to take the stand and confess, I knew I still had to present a strong case during the guilt phase, since it was a safe bet that Watson's testimony would be self-serving. Two, I had to prove, by evidence such as Watson's instructing Linda to steal the $5,000, that although Watson was dominated by Manson, he still had enough independence to make him legally responsible for his acts. One of the key issues during the guilt trial, then, was whether Watson was suffering from diminished mental capacity at the time of the murders. If he was, and it was of such a nature that it prevented him from deliberating and premeditating, the jury would have to find the chief Tate LaBianca killer guilty of second rather than first-degree murder. If convicted of any degree of criminal homicide, then there would be a sanity trial, in which the sole issue would be whether Watson was sane or insane at the time of the murders. I anticipated, and quite rightly, that the defense would call a number of prominent psychiatrists. Eight were called, many of whom would testify that, in their opinion, Watson was insane. Therefore, I'd not only have to subject their testimony to withering cross-examination, I'd also have to present an abundance of evidence showing that Watson was in full command of his mental faculties at the time of the murders, and that he was well aware that in the eyes of society what he was doing was wrong. In short, I had to prove that he wasn't legally insane. Such evidence as his cutting of the telephone wires, his telling Linda to wipe the knives of fingerprints, his manner when talking to Rudolph Weber, and his using an alias when questioned by the authorities in Death Valley a few weeks after the murders, thus became extremely important to proving my case, in that all were circumstantial evidence of a consciousness of wrongdoing and guilt on Watson's part. If Watson was convicted of first-degree murder and also found sane, then the jury would have to decide the ultimate question, whether he was to be given life or death. And this meant I would again face many of the same problems I had with the girls in the penalty phase of the earlier trial. Still another problem was Watson's demeanor. In an obvious attempt to project a college boy image, Watson dressed very conservatively in court, short hair, shirt and tie, blue blazer, slacks. But he still looked strange. His eyes were glassy and never seemed to focus. He reacted not at all to the damning testimony of such witnesses as Linda Kasabian, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and Diane Lake. And his mouth was always slightly gaping, giving him the appearance of being mentally retarded. Taking the stand on direct examination by the defense, Tex played the part of Manson's abject slave. He admitted shooting or stabbing six of the Tate LaBianca victims, but denied stabbing Sharon Tate. And everything which showed either premeditation or deliberation, he put on Manson or the girls. My cross-examination so shook Tex that he often forgot he was supposed to be playing the idiot. By the time I'd finished, it was obvious to the jury that he was in complete command of his mental faculties, and probably always had been. I also got him to admit that he had stabbed Sharon Tate, too, that he didn't think of the victims as people but as just blobs, that he had told Dr. Joel Fort that the people at the Tate residence were running around like chickens with their heads cut off, and that when he said this he had smiled. And I tore to shreds his story that he was simply an unthinking zombie programmed by Charles Manson, as well as cast considerable doubt on his claim that he now felt remorse for what he had done. Watson's testimony cleared up some mysteries. Contrary to the findings of LAPD evidence expert Dwayne Wolfer, Watson identified the pair of red wire cutters found in Manson's dune buggy as the pair he had used to cut the Tate telephone wires that night. Also revealed for the first time were Manson's exact instructions to Watson on the night of the murders at 10,050 Cielo Drive. Watson testified, Charlie called me over behind a car and handed me a gun and a knife. He said for me to take the gun and knife and go up to where Terry Melcher used to live. He said to kill everybody in the house as gruesome as I could. I believe he said something about movie stars living there. And Watson admitted that when he entered the LaBianca residence, he was already armed with a knife. My greatest difficulty during the entire Watson trial came not from the evidence, the defense attorneys, or the defense witnesses, but from the judge, Adolph Alexander, who was a personal friend of defense attorney Sam Bubrick. Alexander not only repeatedly favored the defense in his rulings, he went far beyond that. During voir dire, he remarked, "Many of us are opposed to the death penalty." When prosecution witnesses were testifying, he gave them incredulous, unbelieving looks. When defense witnesses took the stand, he industriously took notes. All this was done right in front of the jury. He also frequently cross-examined the prosecution witnesses. Finally, I'd had it. Asking to approach the bench, I reminded Alexander that this was a jury trial, not a court trial, and that I was immensely concerned that by cross-examining the prosecution witnesses, he was giving the jury the impression that he didn't believe the witnesses. And since a judge has substantial stature in the eyes of a jury, this could be extremely harmful to the people. I suggested that if he wanted to have certain questions asked, he write them out and give them to the defense attorneys to ask. Thereafter, Alexander cut down on his cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses. However, he still continued to amaze me. When the jury went out to deliberate, he didn't even have the exhibits sent back to the jury room, a virtually automatic act, until after I had demanded that he do so. And once, in chambers and off the record, he referred to the defendant as poor Tex. Also off the record was a remark I made to him toward the end of the trial. "You're the biggest single obstacle to my obtaining a conviction of first-degree murder in this case." Despite the problems presented by Judge Alexander, on October 12, 1971, the jury found Watson guilty of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. That I had effectively destroyed the testimony of the defense psychiatrists on cross-examination was borne out by the fact that on October 19th, it took the jury only 2.5 hours to decide that Watson was sane. And on October 21st, after remaining out only 6 hours, they returned with a verdict of death. The trial had lasted 2.5 months and cost $250,000. It also added another 40 volumes, 5,916 pages, to the mini library on the Tate-LaBianca murders. Although Judge Alexander thanked the jury for the conscientious job they had done, he remarked on the day he sentenced Watson, "If I had tried this case without a jury, I possibly would have arrived at a different verdict." In still other proceedings, Susan Atkins pleaded guilty to the murder of Gary Hinman and was given life imprisonment. In sentencing her, Judge Raymond Choate called her a danger to any community who should spend her entire life in custody. The defense obtained separate trials for Charles Manson, Bruce Davis, and Steve Grogan on the combined Hinman-Shea murder charges. Despite the fact that the body of Donald Shorty Shea hadn't been found, and hasn't to this day, prosecutors Bert Katz, Anthony Manzella, and Stephen Kay succeeded in the difficult task of obtaining guilt verdicts against each of the defendants on all of the counts. Verdicts of life imprisonment were returned for Manson and Davis. The Grogan jury voted death, but when it came time for sentencing, 2 days before Christmas 1971, Judge James Colts, commenting that Grogan was too stupid and too hopped up on drugs to decide anything on his own, and declaring that it was really Manson who decided who lived or died, reduced the sentence to life imprisonment. During voir dire in his trial, Manson, angered by the judge's refusal to let him represent himself, told the court, "I enter a plea of guilty. I chopped off Shorty's head." The judge refused to accept the plea, and the next day Manson withdrew it. During another angry outburst, Manson turned to the press and said, "I've told my people to start killing you." Again, Manson was represented by Irving Kenrick. With Irving, he knew it would be a long trial, postponing his trip to San Quentin's death row. Through all the trials, the Manson girls continued their vigil on the corner of Temple and Broadway, literally in the shadow of the Hall of Justice. In view of the thousands of people who passed that corner every day, they fashioned a bizarre plot to free all the imprisoned Manson family members. In late July of 1971, my co-author learned from a family member in the San Francisco Bay Area that the family was planning to break out Manson sometime within the next month. Though he was not told how they intended to accomplish this, he was given some additional details. The family was stockpiling arms and ammunition. They had secretly rented a house in South Los Angeles and were hiding an escaped convict there. And with Manson's escape, Helter Skelter will really start. The revolution will be on. Wishful thinking? I wasn't sure, and passed the information along to LAPD. When I did, I learned that among the witnesses Manson had called in the Hinman Shea trial was a Folsom convict named Kenneth Como, also known by the colorful AKA Jesse James. Though it hadn't been publicized, when brought to Los Angeles less than a week before, Como had managed to escape from the Hall of Records. LAPD doubted, however, that he was still in the area. As for the Manson escape, they had heard rumors also, but nothing definite. They were inclined to doubt the tale. On schedule, less than a month later, the Manson family made their attempt. Shortly after closing time on the night of Saturday, August 21st, 1971, six armed robbers entered the Western Surplus store in the Los Angeles suburb of Hawthorne. While one kept a shotgun on the female clerk and two customers, the others began carrying rifles, shotguns, and pistols to a van parked in the alley outside. They had collected about 140 guns when they spotted the first police car. LAPD, alerted by a silent alarm, had already sealed off the alley. The robbers came out shooting. In the 10-minute gun battle that followed, the van was riddled with over 50 bullets, and some 20 bullets crashed into the black and whites. Surprisingly, no one was killed, though three of the suspects received slight wounds. All six robbers were Manson family members. Apprehended were Mary Brunner, 27, first member of the family, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, 29, and Dennis Rice, 32, both recently freed after serving 90-day sentences for their part in the attempted silencing of Barbara Hoyt. Lawrence Bailey, a.k.a. Larry Jones, 23, who was present the night the Tate killers left Spawn, and escaped convict Kenneth Como, 33. Another family member, Charles Levette, 19, got away during the gunfight but was subsequently apprehended. After their arrest, it was learned that the same group was also responsible for the robbery of a Covina beer distributorship on August 13th, which netted them $2,600. The police surmised that through the robberies, the group intended to get enough guns and ammunition to stage a San Rafael-type commando raid on the courthouse. Steve Grogan had called Manson as a witness in his trial. It was believed that the day Manson appeared in court, the family intended to storm the Hall of Justice, breaking out both. Actually, the real plan was far more spectacular, and given the right circumstances and enough public pressure, it just might have worked. Although never made public before this, according to a family member who was privy to the planning of the Hawthorne robbery, the real plan was as follows. Using the stolen weapons, the family was going to hijack a 747 and kill one passenger every hour until Manson and all the other imprisoned family members were released. Extraordinary security measures were taken during the trial of the Hawthorne robbery defendants, in part because the defense had called as witnesses what Judge Arthur Alarcon labeled the biggest collection of murderers in Los Angeles County at one time. 12 convicted killers, including Manson, Beausoleil, Atkins, Krenwinkel, Van Houten, Grogan, and Davis, took the stand. Their presence in one place made everyone a little nervous, especially since by this time the family had discovered that the Hall of Justice was not escape-proof. In the early morning hours of October 20, 1971, Kenneth Como hacksawed his way through the bars of his 13th-floor cell, climbed down to the 8th floor on a rope made of bedsheets, kicked in a window in the courtroom of Department 104, where just a few months earlier I'd prosecuted Manson and his three female co-defendants, then left the building by way of the stairs. Sandra Good picked up Como in the family van. Though Sandy later smashed up the van and was arrested, Como managed to elude capture for 7 hours. Also arrested, but subsequently released, there being no positive proof that they had aided and abetted the escape, were Squeaky, Brenda, Kitty, and two other family members. No attempt was made to break out Manson during the Hawthorne trial. However, two of the jurors had to be replaced by alternates after receiving telephone threats that they would be killed if they voted for conviction. The calls were linked to an unidentified female family member. Although Gypsy and Rice had previously been given only 90 days for their part in the attempted murder of a prosecution witness, they and their co-defendants found that the courts take shooting at police officers a little more seriously. All were charged with 2 counts of armed robbery. Rice pleaded guilty and was sent to state prison. The others were convicted on both counts and given the following sentences. Lovett, 2 consecutive 5-year-to-life terms. Cher, 10 years to life. Como, 15 years to life. Brunner and Bailey, 20 years to life. Sandra Good was subsequently tried for aiding and abetting an escape. Her attorney, the one and only Irving Kenrick, claimed she had been kidnapped by Como. The jury didn't buy it, and Sandy was given 6 months in jail. The day Como escaped, Kenrick, appearing in Judge Raymond Choate's court, claimed in his patented way, "I allege, with no proof at this particular time, that this escape was deliberately allowed to take place." Judge Choate asked Kenrick if he could explain why Como was forced to climb down a rope from the 13th to the 8th floor. "That makes it look good, Your Honor," Kenrick explained. While Manson was still on trial for the Hinman Shea murders, I dropped into the courtroom one day. It was a welcome relief to be a spectator for a change. Manson, who had recently taken to wearing a black stormtrooper's uniform in court, spotted me and sent a message by the bailiff that he wanted to speak to me. There were a few things I wanted to ask him about also, so I stayed over after court recessed. Sitting in the prisoner's dock in the courtroom, we talked from 4:30 p.m. to nearly 6 p.m. None of the talk concerned the current charges against him. Mostly, we discussed his philosophy. I was especially interested in learning the evolution of some of his ideas and questioned him at length about his relationship with Scientology and with the satanic cult known as the Process, or the Church of the Final Judgment. Manson had wanted to speak to me, he said, because he wanted me to know, "I don't have no hard feelings." He told me that I had done a fantastic, remarkable job in convicting him, and he said, "You gave me a fair trial, like you promised." He was not bitter about the result, however, because to him, prison has always been my home. "I didn't want to leave it the last time, and you're only sending me back there." There were regular meals, not great, but better than the garbage at Spawn Ranch. And since you don't have to work if you don't want to, he'd have plenty of time to play his guitar. "That may be, Charlie, but you don't have any women there," I said. "I don't need broads," he replied. "Every woman I ever had, she asked me to make love to her. I never asked them. I can do without them." "There was plenty of sex in prison," he said. Although Manson again claimed that the Beatles' music and LSD were responsible for the Tate LaBianca murders, he admitted that he had known they were going to happen, "because I even knew what the mice were doing at Spawn Ranch." He then added, "So I said to them, 'Here, do you want this rope? Do you want this gun?' And later I told them not to tell anyone about what happened." Though careful never to do so in open court, in our private conversations, Manson often referred to blacks as niggers. He claimed he didn't dislike them. "I don't hate anyone," he said, "but I know they hate me." Returning to the familiar theme of Helter Skelter, I asked him when he thought the black man was going to take over. "I may have put a clog in them," he replied. "You mean the trial alerted Whitey?" His reply was a simple and sad, "Yeah." Our conversation took place on June 14, 1971. The following day, one of the attorneys complained, and Judge Choate conducted an evidentiary hearing in open court. I testified to the gist of our conversation, noting that Manson had asked to speak to me and not vice versa, and that the current charges were not discussed. There was nothing unethical about this, I observed. Moreover, I'd told Kenrick that Manson wanted to talk to me, but Kenrick had merely walked away. The bailiff, Rusty Burrell, who had sat in on the conversation, staying overtime because he found it interesting, supported my account, as did Manson himself. Manson. The version the man, indicating me, gave was right on. I am almost sure Mr. Kenrick knew that I had asked to see him. I had wanted to speak to this man for the last year, and it was my request that motivated it. As for the hearing itself, Manson said, "Your Honor, I don't think this is fair at all. You know, this was my mistake." Agreeing, and ruling that there had been no impropriety involved, Judge Choate brought the hearing to an end. The irony of all this was not lost on the press, which reported with some incredulity that Manson had taken the stand to defend the man who had convicted him of 7 murders. My interest in the sources of Manson's beliefs stretched back to my assignment to the case. Some of those sources have been mentioned earlier. Others, although inadmissible as evidence in the trial, have more than a passing interest, if only as clues to the genesis of such a sick obsession. I knew, from Greg Jacobson and others, that Manson was an eclectic, a borrower of ideas. I knew, too, both from his prison records and from my conversations with him, that Manson's involvement with Scientology had been more than a passing fad. Manson told me, as he had Paul Watkins, that he had reached the highest state, Theta Clear, and no longer had any connection with or need for Scientology. I was inclined to accept at least the latter portion of his claim. In my rather extensive investigation, I found no evidence of any kind that Manson was involved with Scientology after his release from prison in 1967. By this time, he had gone on to do his own thing. One of Manson's chief disciples, Bruce Davis, was very closely involved with Scientology for a time, working in its London headquarters from about November or December of 1968 to April of 1969. According to a Scientology spokesman, Davis was kicked out of the organization for his drug use. He returned to the Manson family and Spawn Ranch in time to participate in the Hinman and Shea slayings. What effect, if any, Scientology had on Manson's mental state cannot be measured. Undoubtedly, he picked up from his auditing sessions in prison some knowledge of mind control, as well as some techniques which he later put to use in programming his followers. Manson's link with the process, or the Church of the Final Judgment, is more tenuous, yet considerably more fascinating. The leader of the satanic cult is one Robert Moore, whose cult name is Robert de Grimston. Himself a former disciple of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard, Moore broke with Scientology about 1963 to form his own group, after apparently attaining a high position in the London headquarters. He and his followers later traveled to various parts of the world, including Mexico and the United States, and for at least several months, and possibly longer, he lived in San Francisco. He also reportedly participated in a seminar at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, though whether this coincided with any of Manson's visits there is unknown. One of de Grimston's most fervent disciples is one Victor Wilde, a young leather goods manufacturer whose process name is Brother Ely. Up until December of 1967, Victor Wilde's residence and the San Francisco headquarters for the process was 407 Cole Street in Haight-Ashbury. From about April through July 1967, Charles Manson and his still-fledgling family lived just two blocks away, at 636 Cole. In view of Manson's curiosity, it appears very likely that he at least investigated the Satanists, and there is fairly persuasive evidence that he borrowed some of their teachings. In one of our conversations during the Tate-LaBianca trial, I asked Manson if he knew Robert Moore or Robert de Grimston. He denied knowing de Grimston, but said he had met Moore. "You're looking at him," Manson told me. "Moore and I are one and the same." I took this to mean that he felt they thought alike. Not long after this, I was visited by two representatives of the process, a Father John and a Brother Matthew. Having heard that I was asking questions about the group, they had been sent from their Cambridge, Massachusetts headquarters to assure me that Manson and Moore had never met and that Moore was opposed to violence. They also left me a stack of process literature. The following day, the names Father John and Brother Matthew appeared on Manson's visitors list. What they discussed is unknown. All I know is that in my last conversation with Manson, Charlie became evasive when I questioned him about the process. In 1968 and 1969, the process launched a major recruiting drive in the United States. They were in Los Angeles in May and June of 1968, and for at least several months in the fall of 1969, returning to England in about October, after claiming to have converted some 200 American hippies to their sect. Manson was in Los Angeles during both periods. It is possible that there may have been some contact with Manson and/or his group, but I found no evidence of this. I'm inclined to think that Manson's contact with the group probably occurred in San Francisco in 1967, as indicated, at a time when his philosophy was still being formulated. I believe there was at least some contact, in view of the many parallels between Manson's teachings and those of the process, as revealed in their literature. Both preached an imminent, violent Armageddon, in which all but the chosen few would be destroyed. Both found the basis for this in the Book of Revelation. Both conceived that the motorcycle gangs, such as Hell's Angels, would be the troops of the last days, and both actively sought to solicit them to their side. The three great gods of the universe, according to the process, were Jehovah, Lucifer, and Satan, with Christ the ultimate unifier who reconciles all three. Manson had a simpler duality. He was known to his followers as both Satan and Christ. Both preached the second coming of Christ, a not unusual belief, except in their interpretation of it. According to a process pamphlet, "Through love, Christ and Satan have destroyed their enmity and come together for the end, Christ to judge, Satan to execute the judgment." When Christ returned this time, Manson said, it would be the Romans, i.e. the establishment, who went up on the cross. Manson's attitude toward fear was so curious I felt it to be almost unique. At least I felt that until reading in a special issue of The Process magazine devoted to fear. Fear is beneficial. Fear is the catalyst of action. It is the energizer, the weapon built into the game in the beginning, enabling a being to create an effect upon himself, to spur himself on to new heights and to brush aside the bitterness of failure. Though the wording differs, this is almost exactly what Manson preached. Manson spoke frequently of the bottomless pit, the process of the bottomless void. Within the organization, the process was called, at least until 1969, the family, while its members were known as brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. The symbol of the process is similar, though not identical, to the swastika Manson carved on his forehead. Among the precepts of the process which parallel Manson's own, the time of the end is now. The ultimate sin is to kill an animal. Christ said, love your enemy. Christ's enemy was Satan. Love Christ and Satan. The lamb and the goat must come together. pure love descended from the pinnacle of heaven, united with pure hatred raised from the depths of hell. One former process member being interrogated by LAPD in connection with two motorcycle gang slayings, neither of which was connected with the process, said of the cult, "They don't like anybody that they can't indoctrinate or anybody that is not with them. They are just totally against what they call the gray forces, the rich establishment, or the Negroes." Question: why don't they like Negroes? Answer: I don't know. They just don't. Question: they have a natural hate for the Negro? Answer: they have a natural hate, but they would also like to use the Negro as a whole to begin some kind of militant thing. They are really good at picking out angry people. This was merely the opinion of one disaffiliated member, and may well not be the official position of the process itself, but the similarities to Manson's own philosophy are still chilling. These are only some of the parallels I found. They are enough to convince me, at least, that even if Manson himself may never have been a member of the process, he borrowed heavily from the satanic cult. There is at least one precept Manson did not borrow from the group. Unmarried adherents are expected to remain chaste. Nor are these the only connections between the Manson family and Satanists. Bobby Beausoleil was for a time closely associated with filmmaker Kenneth Anger, who was himself deeply involved in both the motorcycle gang mystique and the occult. Beausoleil starred in Anger's film Lucifer Rising, playing the part of Lucifer. This was before he ever met Manson. In his psychiatric report on Susan Atkins, Dr. Joel Hochman wrote of a portion of her San Francisco period, apparently sometime in 1967 or 1968, before she too met Manson. At this time, she entered into what she now calls her satanic period. She became involved with Anton LaVey, the Satanist. LaVey, founder of the San Francisco-based First Church of Satan, is known by those knowledgeable in such matters more as a spectacular showman than as a demonic Satanist. He has stated numerous times that he condemns violence and ritual sacrifice. She took a part in a commercial production of A Witch's Sabbath and recalls the opening night when she took LSD. She was supposed to lie down in a coffin during the act and lay down in it while hallucinating. She stated that she didn't want to come out, and consequently the curtain was 15 minutes late. She stated that she felt alive and everything else in the ugly world was dead. Subsequently, she stayed on her satanic trip for approximately 8 months. During the Tate-LaBianca trial, Patricia Krenwinkel doodled. Her two favorite subjects, according to bailiff Bill Murray, were devil's heads and the Mendes goat, both Satanist symbols. Before he killed him, Charles Tex Watson told Wojtek Frykowski, "I am the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." An apparently important influence on Manson in both precept and example was a dead man, Adolf Hitler. Manson looked up to Hitler and spoke of him often. He told his followers that Hitler had the best answer to everything, and that he was a tuned-in guy who leveled the karma of the Jews. Manson saw himself as no less a historical figure, a leader who would not only reverse the karma of the blacks, but level all but his own Aryan race, his all-white, all-American family. There were both surface and substantive parallels between Hitler and Manson. Both were vegetarians. Both were little men. Both suffered deep wounds in their youth, the psychological scars at least contributing to, if not causing, their deep hatred for society. Both suffered the stigma of illegitimacy, in Manson's case because he himself was a bastard, in Hitler's because his father was. Both were vagrant wanderers. Both were frustrated and rejected artists. Both liked animals more than people. Both were deeply engrossed in the occult. Both had others commit their murders for them. Both were racists. Yet there is some evidence that both also believed they carried the blood of the very people they despised. Many historians believe that Hitler was secretly obsessed with the fear that he had a Jewish ancestor. If Manson's prison records are correct, he may have believed his father was black.